It is a great pleasure to welcome to this conversation Ram Parameswaran. We're going to talk about Ram's philosophy and approach to investing in high-tech businesses. Ram has been tremendously successful in that area. He is founder of Octahedron Capital, which he spun out from Altimeter Capital in April 2020. Ram was a partner and portfolio manager at Altimeter, a $4 billion investment fund based in Menlo Park. Ram, what's quite unique is you invest in both private and public companies and have had success in both areas. I believe Uber is an investment, as is ByteDance, the parent of TikTok. And just for everyone listening, I did have the pleasure of speaking with Ram about his recent quarterly lessons learned, which is a slide deck that Ram and his team put together, basically highlighting some instructive excerpts from earnings calls. And I hope, Ram, you'll continue to do that. It's a terrific resource for all of us. And if everyone listening has a chance to get on that mailing list to get access, that would be wonderful. So, Ram, let's just start fairly early on in your career. How did you get interested in investing? And then what was the catalyst to kind of go down the investing in tech route for you?
Well, John, thank you for having me on the podcast again. I really appreciate it. And, you know, listen, since I got to know you better, MOI Global better, the number of high-quality LPs and investors who reached out saying great things about the MOI community has reached a crescendo in my inbox. So I'm grateful for you having me here. So I am not the typical investment manager. You know, I did not go to an Ivy League school in America. I was not a banker, did not do private equity. You know, I am an accidental investor. And the story really was that, listen, I'm a first-gen immigrant to America. I graduated undergrad in India as an engineer, like many Indians are. And I came to America really to what I call escape middle-class mediocrity. And in the early 2000s, if you were reasonably smart and, you know, ambitious, there were not too many opportunities. So coming to America was a very logical thing for most people who were somewhat ambitious to do. So I packed my bags, took a loan, and I ended up in Virginia Tech, where I got my master's in electrical engineering. And, you know, I was super grateful to get a chance to attend there because it has phenomenal placement rate and an amazing education in double E. After which I ended up as an engineer at a company called Qualcomm out in San Diego. And for people who don't know Qualcomm very well, it is one of the most intense engineering cultures of any company in the world, frankly. And it's just a function of the top-down approach that they have. You know, the person, so there's a legendary professor and entrepreneur called Irvin Jacobs, you know, who started the company back in the early 1990s, and a very intense engineering culture, which is also why you know, it's very hard for an Apple or a Texas Instruments or an Ericsson and a Broadcom to replicate what Qualcomm has in baseband communication. And so anyhow, in the early 2000s, I was an engineer and I spent the first, I'd say 5 years of my life helping Qualcomm commercialize the first many generations of wireless chips. And this was the time when we made the first transition from, you know, a pure voice-based communication system to the first versions of very pokey data connectivity, you know, let's say pre-iPhone 2005, 6, 7, and 8. What happened is my wife, who is now the, you know, one of the who co-runs the growth fund at Y Combinator, which is a pretty famous accelerator here, she ended up going to Wharton for her business school program. And around that time, she had a second cousin, and this gentleman's name is called Karthik Sharma. He runs this fund called SRS, which is an incredibly successful, very high quality, long-term oriented hedge fund that focuses on technology primarily and consumer in New York City. And he spun out of Tiger Tech, and he used to work with Chase Coleman and Feroz Divan and Scott Schleifer, all legends in our business. And when I got to know him in, you know, let's say 2007, 2008, you know, I was really inspired by him because he also came to this country as a first-gen immigrant in the late 90s. And what I realized was you could use a special IP that you create for yourself and you can build a company out of it in a very ROIC light manner, right? Because at the end of it, investing is just all about mostly personal intellectual property and then applying philosophy and intuition and emotional quotient, you know, around that thesis. And so I was inspired by him. And what happened is I then went to the University of Chicago to get my MBA, mainly as a way to break into investing. And it's hard to break into investing, and all your listeners know that. And this is where the focus on technology started. It actually came out of a place of no choice. I mean, listen, if you're an engineer and product manager trying to break into those few select buy-side positions, gosh, back in 2010, it's really hard. And the reason is that it's really hard is because my competition is, you know, just the brilliant, smart other MBA students around you and in other universities all across America, and people with much more experience, right? The classic private equity analysts, hedge fund analysts, banking analysts, and here I was, effectively a nobody who did not even know how to pitch a stock, frankly, right? And the extent of my stock market exposure happened to be watching Jim Cramer on CNBC. So you got to understand, I was so behind the curve, it wasn't even funny. But this is where I had to really think on my feet and realize, okay, how do I distinguish myself in a sea of incredibly capable people when I'm literally at the bottom of the ladder, right? And my view is, listen, I cannot beat somebody on a stock pitch. I could not beat anybody on modeling. I never built an Excel model in my life because engineers don't do Excel models. We do, I think, much more complicated stuff than that. But I realized that maybe I could be the best tech analyst out there. And the best is a relative term. But I said, compared to everybody else, maybe I can focus and go deep. And this is where I guess my attitude on focus really started coming into its own. Now, everyone said, listen, you got to be a generalist analyst. That's the way to get a job. And my view was, if you compare the investing business to, say, medicine, I think the future of the investing business to basically create tremendous alpha in a very crowded market that's getting more and more efficient, generally tending towards efficiency, is to be really good at what you do, right? And going deep in a sector with incredible secular tailwinds behind it. The one episode that jumped out to me was in business school. In 2010, I was pitching Apple Long and I was pitching BlackBerry Short. Now, if you go back to 10 years ago, Apple Long was getting to be a consensus long thesis. It's a very expensive stock, but it was getting to be a consensus long thesis because Apple was on fire. It was already on the second or third generation of the iPhone at that point in time. But what's funny is the BlackBerry Short thesis was incredibly non-consensus in 2010, because if memory serves me right, I think it was trading at a free cash flow multiple of 6 or 7 times, so very cheap stock. And I think they had just introduced the BlackBerry smartphone. And so the logical thesis there was, man, it's a cheap stock. They have these enterprise accounts already. And so it's just a matter of time before consumers upgrade from the BlackBerry keyboard to the BlackBerry smartphone. And I remember there was a big mutual fund that was interviewing me, and I went through my pitch, and halfway through when I started the BlackBerry Short pitch, this gentleman quite cut me off quite unceremoniously and told me that the interview's over. So effectively I got kicked out of the interview. And that's when I really realized that, man, these guys have a lot of investors who typically do research via the sell side or via expert networks have no real idea on how tech actually works. And my variant perception on the BlackBerry Short was quite simple. Now, it came from a little bit of what I call being an insider in the industry. Because remember, I was commercializing Qualcomm chipsets for the last 5 years. Funny enough, I was not sending or observing any of my engineering team going out to Canada to commercialize with Research in Motion. We were all being sent out to Cupertino. And funny enough, before I went to Chicago in 2009, I actually got a job at Apple as a senior engineer. I refused to take the job up because I wanted to do something else with my life. But in a different world, John, we would not be talking because I'd be, you know, living the good life at Apple, right? My point here is that the key insight for me was for all the research and all the smarts and all the management access, people who don't focus and go deep often miss the point completely of how these technology companies get created. And so that was the first insight into focus. What then happened is I spent most of my business school experience trying different kinds of investing. So I worked in a large mutual fund. I worked at Sanford Bernstein on the sell side. I worked at a very famous venture capital firm in Boston called Charles River Ventures. And in the process, I learned a couple of things. One is I fell in love with the research process more than the stock picking process. And so for me, I was very fortunate that I was one of the top ranked summer analysts in 2010 at Bernstein, and they really wanted me to come back and join them full time. Now, because I had that negotiating power, and the funny part is after I got my Bernstein offer, you know, I thought I would apply to the buy side, and I had the distinction of applying to, gosh, more than 400 jobs and getting a grand total of zero offers. So I often tell analysts who are looking for advice and people are starting off that, listen, if a complete naive MBA like me could break into the buy side, I mean, honestly, anybody can. I'm not even that smart. So that's the story of my business school experience, effectively marred by failure and getting on the buy side. But the key philosophies I learned was focus, go deep, and become really good at what you know versus kind of being a mile wide and an inch deep. Around the same time in 2011, when I graduated, I was very lucky. Groupon was a very big deal, and it had taken off. I remember in downtown Chicago, people were standing in lines around buildings, getting into restaurants and retail stores, showing a Groupon on their Apple smartphone and trying to get the coupon from the retailer. And it was at some point, I think it was the fastest company to achieve $1 billion in sales. And coincidentally, the guy who was a CEO of Groupon at the time, a gentleman called Eric Lefkofsky, taught a wonderful class called Building Internet Startups in Chicago in my second year. And I absolutely fell in love. I took his class. I was, I think, the top student in his class or whatever. But it then struck me that, listen, this internet thing cannot be stopped anymore. I mean, it was almost like a continuation of my life, because my first first innings was to kind of create, help build out infrastructure via mobile chips at Qualcomm. And Apple used that technology, put it in the iPhone and built this incredible, smartphone platform. And now it is a question of building applications on top of that infrastructure. And so I went back to Bernstein and I convinced them to put me in the internet team. And this is a very rare thing for them to do, because never in the history of Bernstein, I don't think, had they put a brand new associate who frankly hadn't built a model in his life with, at the time, a total star analyst called Carlos Kirchner. He hadn't even started at Bernstein, but I'd heard his reputation through other analysts. And I basically told Bernstein that, listen, if you don't put me along with Carlos, I am not taking the offer up. Luckily for me, they did not catch my bluff, right? I frankly did not have any other offers, honestly. So if they had said no, I would have been in big trouble. But the reality is they did not catch my bluff. And before I knew it, in 2011, coming out of the great financial crisis, I was paired with the senior analyst called Carlos, who had just, I think, finished a stint at the FCC. And they put this, to work with him as his senior associate. And my view was, it was very asymmetrical for me, because I said, listen, how many chances in life do you get to sit and learn from an incredible person as brilliant as Carlos is, with literally no downside? Because, you know, what'll I do? I'll have to go find a different analyst to work for, maybe, right? Who cares? And what was so surprising to me is two people who were completely naive about, frankly, how Wall Street works, we really put a dent on that sector in a very competitive, very crowded sector. Carlos and me, and mostly Carlos, frankly, for the most part, but he taught me everything. We became, I think, II ranked number one in 2 or 3 years. I think in Bernstein's history, frankly, most of Wall Street's history, this actually never really happened. And so what was the secret? The secret was there was no you know, preconceived notions on what we should do. Everything was focused on going deep and becoming really smart and focusing really hard. So the three pieces of work that I think, you know, Carlos, I'm going to speak for Carlos here, and I'm really proud of, is we were the only firm on Wall Street to, I think, short Facebook or put a big sell rating on Facebook at the IPO. The second piece of work that made Carlos, frankly, really famous, and I, you know, we wrote this famous Bernstein Black Book on this topic, is I, you know, based on client feedback, I think we wrote the seminal piece of on the sell side on the cloud. And this Black Book still makes rounds, you know, here and there, and it's a little embarrassing to see it now. But basically, we had realized that hiding inside Amazon back in 2013. A 5% retail margin business, hiding inside there was a giant called Amazon Web Services. And that business model, at the time, people still assumed was one too early, which is true, but more importantly, thought that Amazon will be selling infrastructure at cost, because Jeff Bezos' philosophy always was your margin, my opportunity. We had the opposite view, which is this is actually a 30% margin, operating margin business. And of course, in 2013, we also said that, hey, by 2020, this business could be greater than $20 billion in size. We nailed the margin number because our calculations were quite accurate. Amazon actually is a 27, 28, 30% margin business in Amazon Web Services. We totally misunderstood or misestimated the top line. But my point is, early on, we were able to nail that piece of analysis. And I feel, you know, I feel happy that I think clients have made billions of dollars on that piece of work that we did. Eventually, because of the quality of work we did, that's how I got my first gig on the buy side. And it's funny, by this time I was very, I really wanted to go and work in an investment firm that had a phenomenal research process. And I was, you know, there was this firm called Falcon Edge that had just spun out of Blue Ridge Capital back in 2012. And they took a shot on me to come and become their tech analyst in 2012, mostly first as a consultant and then with a chance of getting converted full time. And frankly, listen, for me, I was very impressed with their intensity. I was impressed with their quality of research. And so I left Bernstein in 2013 to join Falcon Edge. And that's where really I think I figured out my buy-side investing process. Very intense, very deep, very modeling heavy and modeling oriented, a very research intensive on the ground analysis. And so that is where I think I really made the transition, I'd say, gosh, 6 to 7 years ago, going from a sell side research oriented analyst to a stock picker. So the point is that it's been a relatively recent journey for me. I've not been doing this for, you know, one or two decades. Point here is that, you know, one, I became good at stock picking. I always love picking stocks. I'm kind of obsessed with it, like most good analysts are. But number two, you know, I was sent to China for the first time in 2013. This is in October 2013. And I was sent along with the China analyst, a gentleman called George Yang, who runs this fund in Hong Kong called Anatoly. And George is an incredible investor. And I would highly recommend you have him on your show at some point. And George and me go out to China to diligence this company called Didi Taxi. And we do the work and we come back completely, you know, pounding the table to our team to go and put a term sheet in. Now, I'm not going to go into details of what happened at Didi Taxi, but the insight I had there was this public thing is really interesting. And I'm going to keep trying to become really good on the public investing side. But because companies are staying private longer and longer, if I do not do private investing, you know, in the long term, I don't think I would have built a sustainable competitive moat for myself. So what happened is in 2014, I convinced my boss at the time, Rick Gerson, who started Falcon Edge, to allow me to help him build out a growth fund, but this one focused on India. So why India? Because honestly, we already had a super smart analyst covering China. Silicon Valley at the time for a fund in New York was hard to break into because Silicon Valley is a bit of a, what I call insular culture for outsiders. It's, you have to be in the know of things and it takes time to do that. But India is where what I call we had home court advantage. One is Falcon Edge had pretty large India public portfolio, and I could then marry the little stuff I knew in technology to invest in India via a technology growth fund. And that's how I really cut my teeth in public and private investing. This was first starting at Falcon Edge, first in China and then in India. And we had, of course, I had my fair share of failures, but I learned a lot from it. But then started learning quickly from those failures and then started picking some pretty good companies in India. Now, fast forward, this is all 2014. And what happened is my wife, who frankly is, we celebrated our 15th wedding anniversary yesterday. And, you know, I kind of told her that she, she totally got the tough end of the stick because, you know, I lucked out and maybe she did not. But what's interesting is she was at BCG in Boston, in New York, and she was running the private equity practice. And, she was consulting for Carlyle, Apollo, the big private equity firms. And she was itching to get to the buy side, except for the fact that nobody wanted to really hire a consultant on the buy side as an investor. They wanted her to do operations. And my wife, being the very gutsy lady she is, she's like, you know, screw that. I want to be an investor. And she was very lucky to get a job at a legendary investment firm in California called Andreessen Horowitz. And so so for her job, we left New York in the end of 2014 and came out of California. And then, during that time, I opened the Falcon Edge office of California, but then eventually I kind of decided to really move on. So that was the second phase of my life, where I went from the research analyst perspective to becoming a stock picker and really understanding the public and private methodology. And then I got lucky again, where in 2013, I had met this incredible gentleman called Brad Gerstner. And Brad at the time had started Altimeter. The fund, I think, was 5 or 6 years old at the time. And I met him at a Focusrite conference in Florida, because I was the analyst on Priceline at that point in time. And Brad was known at the point to be probably the best investor in online travel at that point in time. And when I met him in 13, it felt like I just found a philosophical elder brother. He was focused, he was driven, he wanted to be the world's best at a few things. And at the end of our breakfast meeting, I was super grateful. He actually gave me kind of a job on the spot. And I actually rejected it because I had a great job in New York, I started at Falcon Edge, I wasn't going to move to California for him. Now, fast forward 2 years later, I went back to him and said, hey, do you still have that job that you kind of offered me 2 years ago? And very luckily for me, he had not found an analyst to take that spot, so he brought me on board. And that is where I made the shift from what I call an investment analyst to a portfolio manager. Because over the last 5 years, under the Altimeter umbrella, I had this incredible fortune to take my insight and Brad gave me the chance to paint that canvas. So the insight I had was, one, investing has to be focused to do really well. Two, investing has to be global in nature, because I was an internet analyst, and guess what? If you want to order food in Bogota, it's the same idea of ordering food in Mumbai, and it's the same idea of ordering food in New York City. It's the same thing. People have the same needs wherever they are in the world. And so I was able to build out, using the Altimeter infrastructure, a track record and the brand and the confidence to go and really put out this insight of doing public and privates at scale. And the difference between the Altimeter strategy and most other funds that also have private equity firms built in is, unlike many firms that have a big public team and a big private team, Brad's thesis was the same sector head should do both things. So we may have multiple products underneath. So a growth fund, a growth fund and a hedge fund. But the reality is should be simple. Our job should be to go find great business models, find great entrepreneurs, and take a long-term view and add real value to those entrepreneurs and try to get capital in and hopefully hold it for a very long time. Now, the reason that you can only do it in a focused manner is if you were, for example, covering, let's say, software and hard technology and semiconductors and hardware and then internet and then media, it's too hard. You just cannot become, first of all, you can't even do that much work. It's too much to do. Second of all, there are no network effects between the two. It's not like understanding hardware makes you any better on the software side. So the entire strategy there was, well, let's pick a niche and let's go deep. So the niche that I picked up, and I was very lucky to do this, is I started covering global internet and global payments. And Altimeter really covers three sectors. We did global internet, global payments, we did software, and we did travel. And you know, we've had, knock on wood, tremendous success in all these areas. And so I was very lucky again to find a team and a boss where culture was fantastic, people were fantastic, and I'm just so grateful for the 4 or 5 years I spent there. And so over the last 5 years, I was very lucky. One, I was able to make that transition from a analyst to a portfolio manager, because that transition is just really hard. And frankly, most people fail at doing it. And number two, I built the process and the infrastructure needed to seamlessly do publics and privates at scale within the internet and payment sector. And this meant having the brand to do it in the private markets across the world, and having the experience and the philosophies needed to do it well on the public markets as well. And this is really hard to do because it's very much a left brain, right brain kind of interaction. So a lot of people call me saying, hey man, this crossover idea is so interesting. It's obvious. And I often tell people it is very, very, very hard. And the reason it is hard is because it's very much of left brain, right brain. The right brain is all about the public markets, sentiment analysis, deep modeling, understanding the puts and takes of the wiggles of the market, understanding probabilities, right? Right? And in the public and the private markets, it's a very possibility-driven business, right? What could this company look like in 5 or 6 years? How do we understand if there are ups and downs in these companies, which happen all the time? Man, private investing is really hard because you really appreciate how difficult it is for these entrepreneurs to build these great companies. Things happen all the time that you never expect. And having that empathy for the entrepreneur, having that access to get into the best deals, is just something you've got to build over time. And the way we built it was, one, we were in California. So I think there is what I call unfair advantage because of geography. And number two, you know, I've made on Altimeter's behalf, gosh, probably 30 trips to China over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. And so a lot of blood, sweat, and tears just went into that flight from SF to Beijing every couple of months to build, understand, and learn. But, you know, fortunately for me and the team, I was able to help them build a pretty good portfolio on the internet side, which has performed quite well over the last few years, which has made our LPs, you know, a lot of money. And, you know, at the end of it, at the end of that 5 or 4 year journey, I started thinking about, okay, what's next? And the reason why what's next came about is I'm all about learning and scaling and taking risk in life. Because if you don't take risk in life, frankly, I've just realized you don't get anywhere. And what I started learning was, listen, I took my first risk by going to the sell side, and I frankly knew nothing about the sell side. I took my second risk by, you know, leaving a very stable job with high profile at Bernstein, doing really well, to become a consultant in a hedge fund with no chance of getting a full-time offer, with no real guaranteed chance of a full-time offer, to leaving a $3 billion firm or $4 billion firm in New York at the time around the California office to join a smaller, lower profile firm, but with frankly what I thought had explosive potential. And taking risk in the process. And almost every single time people said, you're an idiot. Like, why would you take the risk? Life is so easy. And my point here is that I've always learned that risk taking or responsible risk taking is just really important to develop a career. So by the middle of 19, I was relatively convinced that I wanted to build a fund. And mostly because I was just inspired by my old boss. Like, he built the fund from, I think, $3 million in AUM. I think the first day he raised capital, I think $3 million hit his bank account. And by the time I left, he had built a $3 to $4 billion business. And for me, I was very fortunate to have played a small role in helping him build that piece of the business out. When I joined the firm, I think the firm was $1 billion in size and helped him scale and do well for our LPs. And I had the real itch to go and now do this on my own with the good fortune that I had already seen the rodeo once. And then I asked myself, what is the competitive advantage I have? And I figured out that one, living in California is an unfair advantage because we see what is happening on the ground for the most part. Our network, our LPs, our team members happen to be industry practitioners versus getting our research off an expert network. I had built what I call a solid brand in India. We put a lot of money in India and we had built a good brand in China. So I understood how those markets worked. I built a track record on the public side, which, you know, I was very fortunate that brand allowed me to take along with me, and a track record on the private side that I was able to take along with me as well. And most importantly, you know, again, I've had the good fortune of working with a team where Brad was my first check into the fund. Like the minute I said I wanted to leave, I mean, of course, you know, he really did not want me to go. And, you know, we had a lot of discussions, but having the fortune to have a boss who said, listen, go, if you're crazy enough to go do it and start it. But, you know, I'd love to support you with a little bit of capital and let's be very close to each other. Almost made it what I call, again, another asymmetrical opportunity to go and build something. And so that was the origins of Octahedron, where I feel like we're going to focus on the future of the internet. It's something I've done for close to a decade. I think we know the space really well. We built a great brand all over the world in the public and the private market, so we get access to almost anything we want to. And now the hope is keep our heads down, focus on our process, and try to be good stock pickers and not overcomplicate the problem. You know, most people overcomplicate investing. And my view is it's actually quite simple. So the philosophy in Altimeter is we run concentrated books. We don't, you know, we don't own 30 stocks and, you know, short 60 stocks, which I think that era is done. We typically, as a fund at Octahedron, we own between 6 and 10 companies, maybe 12 companies. And, you know, I tend to add 1 to 2 private companies every year. We just did our first private investment, you know, 2 or 3 months ago in ByteDance again, which tells you the conviction I have on that business. And then we're just about closing a second private investment right now. And then, you know, to the extent we short things, I've been a short seller for a long time. It's getting harder and harder these days, I promise you, especially with the Fed's announcement recently. We tend to short stuff on the wrong side of change. So, you know, that's the business model. That was the setup. And that was my longish story into investing.
Well, that's a fascinating path. Thank you so much for sharing. And you just talked about this attitude on focus. I think that is such an important point. Maybe tell us a little bit about, you know, what you do on a day-to-day basis to keep building that, you know, circle of competence, that depth in the area of the internet. You know, how do you spend your time?
You know, it's incredibly boring the way I spend my time most of the day. So as a fund, we generally cover 40 stocks. The sectors we cover, the subsectors we cover are internet, which means the front end part of the internet. Happens to be marketplaces like Etsy and gaming companies like Sea Limited, e-commerce companies like Alibaba, home services companies like Angie's List, et cetera, et cetera. And the back end of the company, the back end of our coverage happens to be payments companies such as Adyen and Square. And we cover, you know, some software companies that look and feel like internet companies such as Slack, for example. On a day-to-day basis, it's the same as almost every portfolio manager. So my team is very small. I have one analyst. We're probably adding a second analyst this year. And I have one operations person. And, you know, we have an apartment in San Francisco because, I had to think on my feet. We had to get a place to work out of and, you know, in the middle of COVID. And so on a day-to-day basis, most of the time, our time is focused on specific names, not portfolio management. We are trying to read a lot, learn a lot, talk to industry practitioners, understand the controversies in a specific stock, understand if we have any variant perception relative to that consensus thesis, and then making a decision on what is the fair value of the business in every year going out 5 years, and most importantly, understanding what is the downside of owning the stock at a point in time and whether our dollars are served by owning any alternative stock in the same space. So our entire business runs on Slack. And one thing I want to mention is not only is focus one of the tenets of the firm, but you know, one of the key learnings in this firm is we are a business that is very much focused on learning. It's a learning-oriented organization. And one of the challenges in most organizations are there is a lack of communication between people. So everyone sends the PM a bunch of emails or texts them. And mostly it is to, you know, it's for upward communication. But what happens in most firms are people do not look out for their colleagues. So one of the rules I have in the firm is from day one, the entire business is run on Slack. So I keep my emails to a minimum. I actually don't even read emails for the most part. At this point, I have, I think, 14,000 emails unread on my Gmail. And frankly, who cares? Everybody is focused on specific stocks. So the way my team is organized is, you know, those 40 stocks we cover, along with their private equivalents, are generally split up into 8 subsectors. And then on average, an analyst covers 2 subsectors. So an analyst covers 10 to 12 stocks. And the expectation is that he or she is fully immersed in those stocks. News articles, thesis, technology, happenings, hirings, firings. And what happens is whenever they read a piece or learn something, they put the piece out on Slack. And the expectation is we summarize everything in 3 sentences or less. That's an important rule, summarization of key points. And what happens is you have these crazy network effects here then. So because as somebody adds information to the Slack channel, other people pick up and learn from it without being too distracted, and they add to the Slack channel again. And so the richness of knowledge keeps compounding within the fund. So most days I am usually picking one stock that I want to personally understand and research myself. Pretty standard. I read the transcripts. I try to see if I can find the management team. We try to see if we can get alternate sources of data to track the company because we take big positions and I want to see that, you know, at least on an intra-quarter basis, we're in the same direction. In a couple of other firms, I've run the data teams for those teams anyways. I've built up these data infrastructures for the last 4 or 5 years, so nothing new to us. And then really trying to figure out whether we should be, you know, adding to a position or taking off a position or frankly doing nothing most of the time. And then also constantly having this list of companies where I feel like, you know, you can't know 40 companies cold. You probably know 25 to 30 companies really well. But okay, how do we get to know these newer companies quite well? And especially in a world today where some incredible companies are going public, how do we ramp up our knowledge in those specific areas is kind of where I'm focused on. So all of last week, we were trying to figure out, you know, we've known Unity for a long time. You know, we've invested in Unity in a previous fund. And now it's a question of, okay, the company is going public. Should we participate in the IPO? We will. We think tremendously highly of the management team. And it's this wonderful business model where it's infrastructural to what I think is a future of content consumption in the world. And so we've got to know the company really well. We've got to understand how differentiated their ad business model is. The CEO talked about having this cloud business that nobody understands. So we're digging deep into that. And then most importantly, what's engaging me now is, you know, there's a lot of technological mumbo jumbo in many ways out there on gaming technology and gaming engines. You know, this weekend, the team and I are going to go do a deep dive on the technological implementations of one game engine versus the other. My point here is, listen, we don't know the first thing about Tesla or Nikola or electric vehicles, but we want to know a lot about a few things. And so most of the time, my work is in going deep and understanding the products, understanding the people, understanding the salespeople, understanding the business model. And then most importantly, every position, if we're not just qualitative in nature, the entire business is really run out of the models that they run for specific stocks. So we put a lot of what I call emphasis on our modeling work, with the expectation that on a 1 quarter, 1 year, and 3 year basis, we are able to see some massive variant perception on either revenues or on EBITDA or on earnings or free cash flow. We have to basically see a huge delta, else we're unlikely to make it a big position.
How do you think about valuation, and where does that fit into your investment process?
Yeah, valuation is actually very important. And the view on valuation has actually changed quite dramatically over time. So we've always been a growth oriented, I've always had a growth mentality to investing. And I'm okay with paying high multiples for companies as long as the company has momentum and it's going in the right direction. That said, there are companies right now where I just don't understand anymore. And I think it's just a function of being living at a point in time when the Fed rates are going to be zero for the foreseeable future. And we have a fair bit of liquidity in the market. And we have a lot of retail investors who have a channel to invest in. And so in certain parts of the tech economy, we see what I call, close to what I call speculative mania. But we as a firm tend to be quite valuation sensitive. Now, what I mean by that is, this is not about putting a specific multiple or running a DCF. The things I care about is, what is long-term free cash flow generation? Or what is long-term EBITDA generation? Number two, what I care about is, are the ROICs going up or going down? Is the company, if the ROICs are going down, is it driven by sales or is it driven by research and development costs? If they pulled away sales and marketing, if they pulled away R&D, if they were not spending the money to keep ahead and leave their competitive moat, what would true earnings look like? So what would long-term earnings look like? Now, it's all qualitative at the end of it, but I'm looking for companies that are generally trading within their median EV to EBITDA or median PE or median EV to sales even over a three-year basis. And that is the hard part because, frankly, valuations are going up, right? So we have to change our reference frame accordingly. An even more important component of the valuation is actually just not the upside analysis, but the downside analysis. And this is where I think, you know, that's my biggest learning as I transition from an analyst to a PM, which is the question to ask is, how badly can you get hurt? And so we have this framework that I use called the downside analysis, and then what I call the back of the truck analysis. Like, when would I be happy to take a 15, 20% position in a specific stock? And the back of the truck and the downside analysis is almost as important as our upside analysis, right? Because especially in a market like this, you know, we are what I call playing pretty solid defense, right? Because who knows what's going to happen. And so knowing how badly you get hurt is almost as important as how much money you will make. So generally the rule of thumb when we add positions or initiate a position is, I expect to make, you know, 20 to 25% on a net basis over a 12 to 18 month, which means we have catalysts and we have a variant perception and the company has momentum on its side. But more importantly, I want to make that 20, 25, 30% net minimum using a 1-to-3 risk reward. So if we lose money, we could be down 15%, 10 to 15%. And if we make money on a 12 to 18 month period, we are up between 25 and 45%. So I look for those 1-to-3 risk rewards. And as we reach closer to my downside case, that's when we get more excited and greedy and size up the position. Now, at the end of it, this is just a quantitative framework for me to have, you know, to exercise what Warren Buffett has always told, which is be fearful people are greedy and vice versa. But what I learned for me personally is it is just harder than you think it is. When shit goes down, man, it is bad. It is tough. Everyone's scared. Everyone's freaking out, by the way. Even the most experienced PMs are nervous at that point in time. It is just a human fear when the markets are vicious to be scared. For me, what I've done is the way I get over being scared, right? The way I get around, you know, holding my nerve when things are going really badly is this quantitative framework to understand how badly can things go, right? And where do we see positions where we should be taking, increasing our positions because there's valuation support and there is business support and there is growth support over a 12 to 18 month period, right? And ultimately, the question really comes down to something very simple. Am I proud to hold this company? Will this be a bigger business in 3 to 4 years than it is today? And is this a management team that I can trust to do work on behalf of our shareholders? And are they going to create wealth for all of us over time? So generally what I've seen is when I've invested in subpar managers or when I've invested in subpar business models, but that is not growth oriented, which is most EBITDA oriented and, you know, cash flow collection, it just hasn't really worked for me in the long term. And so again, it's just at the end of it, you know better than most, John, that investing is an incredible personal business. So again, every day I'm just trying my best to tweak my process to most align my personal, you know, mental philosophical makeup, and then hopefully to observe what's happening in the market and maybe try to get smarter about matching the Legend Star business.
You talked about private versus public a little bit. I'd love to dig into that a little bit more in terms of how the process may differ and how the key variables that you look at in your investment analysis differ.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So the diligence process, the analysis, you know, is very similar. Because at the end, remember, when I talk about crossover investing or the way I was trained at Altimeter, I don't do venture investments. I don't do early stage investments. I don't take both seats, right? It's too much work. For me, a lot of this inspiration comes from the legendary Henry Ellenbogen, right? Who started crossover investing at T. Rowe Price and now runs Durable and who is a friend of the firm from 10 years ago. So it's a very simple thesis. The diligence is the diligence is the diligence, right? You find companies that have great management teams, attacking tough markets, big markets, have a growth-oriented mentality, have real unit economics working in their favor, and a long-term path to a lot of free cash flow generation. That's very simple. So the work, the diligence work is the same. The calls, the people we talk to, the data sources we use, very similar between the public and private markets. The difference is having the instinct to know that this is the company to go after, and this is the company that has momentum behind it. Because the challenge in the private markets is once you get in, you really can't get out till a liquidity even happens. So the bar for putting money in a private investment for us is frankly much higher than the bar for investing in a public company. So that's number one. Which means we are, again, we don't do everything, right? And I think that in itself is a competitive advantage, because if you're in a traditional growth fund, your business model is predicated on raising a bunch of capital, deploying that in 2 or 3 years, and then going right back and raising capital all over again, right? In our business, we don't have to take shots on goal just because, you know, we have to get deals done. So the bar to invest is higher. So the questions I ask myself is this a management team who is young enough and has the longevity to take this company from X to Y? Will this company, will this management team, will the CEO, does she or he have the capability to manage and navigate the public markets? And number three is, does the business model have multi-year, maybe multi-decade compounding effects, inbuilt into it? And then the other bar that I use is, hey, you know, we got to get paid for illiquidity. So the rule of thumb I have is if I'm trying to attempt to make 20 to 25% net in the public markets over, let's say, a 12 to 18 month period, then I've got to make a good 1,000 to 1,500 bips at least incremental on a private investment, which basically then means that post dilution, because there is dilution in these private companies, and post even currency risk, because we invest all over the world, we've got to hit that IRR threshold. The key, of course, is, you know, when we own a public stock, you know, while we have smart, tax-efficient ways of hedging the position and taking risk off the table, generally, I almost never sell a share, because it's probably easier to be tax efficient by not selling than by selling and buying, you know, over and over again, because it all hurts our LPs and frankly hurts me personally as well. So therefore, what I tend to do is my time period on which I look at every investment is typically a rolling 3-year period. So the rule of thumb is, one, on the private side, I've got to make a good 1,000 to 1,500 bips on top of the 2,000 bips I expect to make on a public position on a 3-year basis. So in general, if I cannot double, if not triple my money in 3 years on a private position, minimum under undemanding condition, in my bear case, I just won't do it. So the bar is high. And I think what happens is when the bar is high, you're not constantly seduced into chasing these deals and competing with the great growth funds in the world. Instead, you can understand the business model, hopefully be a value-added partner to the entrepreneurs, and which also means that the goodwill compounds over time. So you can buy it in the private market, or you can wait, or you can do pre-IPO, or you can buy it at the IPO, or whatever. It's a way of becoming smarter on a specific company. So that's the difference in public and private. And the word crossover is used in a very careless fashion, I feel like, but I wanted to be very specific on what crossover means from an octahedron perspective.
That's very helpful. Thank you. And just loosely, so we get a feel for the makeup of the portfolio, do you have any kind of target for private versus public? And similarly, do you have any kind of target for long versus short?
Yeah, it's a great question. On the public side, there is a fine line between being too illiquid and being too liquid. So for me, what I found that works for most of our investor base happens to be up to 25% privates at cost. So for $100 put in, we can invest up to $25 in private companies. And I think that's a great kind of threshold to be at, because anything more, and then you've got to, the LP has to get his private team to underwrite us, et cetera, et cetera. And so it makes life too complicated. Anything lesser, and I think the power of the crossover fund does not really come into place. So that's number one. Number two is, longs versus shorts. No, we have no target, right? I've been a short seller for years now. In fact, when I first started at Falcon Edge, part of the intense training I went through was mostly on the short side. So I actually started my life mostly as a dedicated short analyst, believe it or not, seven years ago. My views have evolved quite dramatically, because one of the challenges in short selling today is the Fed has told us that they don't want us shorting, right? We are fighting the Fed. We've been fighting the Fed for a few years now. And again, it's getting harder and harder. So my point is, we do not short for the sake of shorting, right? We have not promised any LPs a target gross and net. So we don't short stuff just because we have to short. That's not the business model. That said, when we see a short on goal based on a fundamental thesis, not as just a simple trade, on a fundamental thesis, we will absolutely take that short on goal. So, right now we have a fair bit of short exposure. And unfortunately, to our detriment, that has hurt us in the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 months. But, my sense is short selling is like going to the gym. If you ever want to become strong, you got to go in every day. You got to sweat. You got to get your butt kicked and become strong. You can't wake up one day and say, oh, today I'm going to be a short seller. It's just not going to work that way. And so this is the hard part. I think where we've gotten comfortable with is don't short for the sake of shorting. None of our LPs pay us to do that. And when we see a short on goal, we take it. We should not be scared or fearful at that point in time. And so that's my philosophy on both the public-private side and the long and short side.
And I'm curious, just because you do have a background in EE and Qualcomm, your views on hardware versus software opportunities long-term, there do seem to be some hardware companies out there that are interesting, like NVIDIA, that kind of are building some of the infrastructure that's going to be required for the future of the internet. Do you have any desire to, let's say, expand the circle of competence, even though it sounds like you already would have that within your circle, given your background, but how do you look at, kind of expanding the set of potential opportunities over time?
That's a wonderful question. And I really want to attack this head on, because when I talk about hardware, I'm talking about box hardware. So I'm talking about Cisco, EMC, Dell, those kinds of companies. NVIDIA is a semiconductors company. And we have a very strong ongoing thesis that I think we are now in what I call the golden age of semiconductors in the world, period. And it's a pretty simple observation, because pick your smartphone and peel out every layer of the smartphone. Almost every layer of the smartphone, baseband, RF, antenna, whatever, pick your poison, is built by a duopoly or an oligopoly, right? So there's one or the other, right? And so that's one thesis, which is, you know, we are absolutely interested and excited about semiconductors. The reason why it actually fills our frame of reference, our flywheel effect of knowledge, is, again, what drives the internet? A lot of machine learning infrastructure. Well, machine learning infrastructure has hardware and software components to it. The hardware companies, the semiconductors companies that drive the machine learning infra forward, happens to be the forward-looking semis companies of our lifetime. So these are companies like NVIDIA, absolutely. So, and by the way, NVIDIA might be a semiconductors company, but the reality is it has a pretty huge software stack. In fact, if I remember right, there's a stat that says there are more software engineers working at NVIDIA than even hardware engineers. That's actually true for many semiconductors companies. So when it comes to machine learning, when it comes to the growth of cloud and therefore the growth of internet, we absolutely do look at specific semiconductors companies. And the companies that I think are some of the best in the world in this space happen to be NVIDIA. And if they end up acquiring ARM, that's going to be an absolute behemoth. What we do not cover is companies like Intel, right? Because Intel doesn't do anything from our frameworks and, you know, taking forward the GDP of the internet. We look at all the new architectures coming out for training and machine learning, right? Especially on the private side. And then the last piece is, again, if you take even a step behind, who are the ultimate beneficiaries in this explosion of semiconductors? I think it's the big fabricators of the world, right? So you pick TSMC, for example, out in Taiwan, especially with Intel's dominance definitely under threat right now. TSMC seems to be a huge winner on a multi-decade period. And so on and so forth. So a very insightful question and absolutely part of the circle of competence.
Wonderful. Well, this has been so amazingly insightful. We like to end these conversations with a question on any recommendations you would have in terms of resources or books for our listeners who would like to build their circle of competence within the internet space. Anything you would recommend on that front?
You know, the book I'm reading right now, and I should have read it, gosh, a while ago, is on the technical side, is I'm, you know, now that Snowflake went public and my old team, so proud of them, they were big investors in Snowflake. The CEO is a legendary gentleman called Frank Slootman. He's taken three companies public now, Data Domain, ServiceNow, and now Snowflake. And he wrote this book called Tape Sucks in 2009. So I am rereading that book right now. I think it's super interesting. You know, otherwise, as an entrepreneur now, I am more focused on understanding company culture. So, you know, yesterday I was rereading the Netflix culture deck, along with Reed Hastings just published his book called No Rules Rules. So those are the two books I'm reading right now. So Reed Hastings' new book called No Rules Rules. And if you don't want to read the book and spend the money on that, just read the Netflix culture deck. It's a legendary deck. I think it's published on the web somewhere. And then on the technical side, kind of really re-understand, learning two things. One is game engine design, what's happening there, and rereading anything that Frank Slootman has put out recently.
Terrific. Well, Ram, thank you so much for spending the time and for sharing your wisdom and insights. We truly appreciate it.
I am super grateful for having me here, and you know, everybody be well.
All the best to you. I look forward to circling back with you in the future. Goodbye for now.
Thank you.